Good morning. This is hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus, we will be talking about the connections between two things that I expect probably most people don't really think of as being connected. And the two things are energy and water. Now, it is certainly true that it requires energy to produce and distribute water, but it is also true that it requires water, and we're talking about significant amounts of water, to produce energy. As the global demand for energy grows, it's expected to put increasing pressure on the world's water resources, resources that are already under pressure. And that could indeed lead to increasing competition for water between the energy industry and agriculture and domestic use. And the question a lot of people are confronting is, will there be enough water to meet the demands of all of these users, say, 20 years from now? Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to explore some of these questions. And our guest is Mike Hightower. He's a distinguished member of the technical staff in the Energy Security Center at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's a civil and environmental engineer. He has over 30 years' experience in research and development projects, and currently his efforts include doing research and evaluation of environmental and energy technologies and security and protection of critical water and energy infrastructures. He is joining us this morning by telephone, and questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, join in the conversation, and you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if you're listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you're listening on the internet, no matter where you are, you may use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, people can call. We just ask that callers are brief in their questions, but you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Hightower, hello.
Hello, David. How are you
doing? I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
I'm doing well.
Good. I appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I'm really glad that that you could do this and that we could be talking about this subject because, as I said, I think that the significance of water in energy production is something that I expect would be a new idea to a lot of people, and it certainly was to me. And it wasn't until just recently, in fact, that there was an article in our local newspaper about this subject, and I saw it and I read it, and I thought, say, this is very interesting. We should be talking about this. It's as I say, I think for a lot of people, this connection will be something that's a new idea.
Yes, I think a lot of people don't realize how much water we use on a daily basis for electric power generation in the United States, and as we move toward alternative fuel supplies, in some cases biofuels, or as they're doing in Canada, tar sands, or as we may do in the United States, oil shale, there's the potential for significant increase in the amount of water we use for transportation fuels also. So we're seeing a potential for a large growth in energy demands for electric power in the next 25 years, and with that, increases in water demands. And then as well as I mentioned, increases in alternative transportation fuels, which are also going to have potentially significant water demands in the future.
If you just ask a question like this, if you look at all of the various users of water, look at residential use, and then you look at the various kinds of industrial use, and there you would include agriculture, other industrial users, energy producers, in terms of how much water they use relative to one another, how do these various users rank?
How they stack up?
Yeah, how they stack up, yeah.
Well, the largest, I'm going to use two terms here. One is withdrawals, which is where you actually withdraw water from either groundwater or surface water supplies. And in many cases, there are industries that withdraw water, they use it, and then it goes back into a river or a stream. system. And then there is consumption, where the water has withdrawn and then the water is totally consumed. There's no water to put back into a stream. A couple of examples might be a power plant that withdraws water for cooling and then puts that water back into a river. Then that would be a withdrawal. There are power plants that withdraw water and then they have large evaporative cooling systems where a lot of the water that they draw in is evaporated through cooling. And that would be a consumptive use. In other words, they would use all of that water. In a municipality, a similar approach similar concept is we take in a lot of water for drinking water and for bathing. We consume some of that water. We put some of that water on our lawns, and it is not returned to the river. But some of it goes in as wastewater and then goes down and is put back into the river as wastewater. So water we withdraw for domestic consumption, a lot of that is returned as wastewater into a stream. So there is withdrawals and there is consumption. So on the withdrawal side, the two major sectors that withdraw the most water in the United States, one is irrigated agriculture, and the second highest, and almost the same as irrigated agriculture, is electric power generation. About 39% to 40% of all the water withdrawn on a daily basis in the United States is for agriculture, and at the same time, about 40% of all the water withdrawn in the United States on a daily basis is for electric power generation. So those are the two largest sectors for withdrawals. You can see why, then, that when you start having droughts and you're beginning to get limited water supplies, there's a lot of concern about energy development. On the consumption side, agriculture is still the largest consumer of water. In other words, consumptive use. Domestic consumption is about second, and electric power is third in as far as consumptive uses. But the withdrawal standpoint is something that I'd like to go back to, and that is that in electric power generation, you have to have the water in the streams or the rivers to be able to do your cooling. And when we're withdrawing 40% of all the water on a daily basis for that, if you do get droughts or extended periods of droughts or additional competition for food or for domestic consumption, you can see that it's going to start to limit how much water we're going to have in the future to meet our energy demands and energy supplies. So that's currently, and what we're looking at in the future is for electric power generation, maybe a growth of a factor of 3 in the amount of water consumption that we're going to see in electric power generation over what we're doing today, so that drives the consumption up. And in the biofuels area, there is concern that we'll continue to use more and more water for producing biofuels or producing alternative transportation fuels, both for the crop irrigation as well as production, which will also double or triple or quadruple the amount of water we use in transportation fuels. That could make the energy sector in 25 years the largest user of water in the United States on a daily basis, largest withdrawal, and second only to agriculture in consumptive uses of water. So that's kind of the trends. Hopefully I laid that out for your listeners, but it's that's how it's growing, and that's where it ranks today and may rank in the future.
That's really gives you pause, certainly when you think about now around the world how water is certainly a growing issue. And you think about that primarily as water that's used for human consumption, but perhaps also in agriculture. This idea that the energy industry should be such a big user of water, not now a big user of water, and we're 25 years from now, that's not that long. Then in a couple of decades, it could in fact be the number one user of water. I'm sorry, I sort of keep going back to the same thing, but I'm thinking that a lot of people would say, well, gosh, I never really even thought of that.
Mm-hmm. And we use most of the water used in the United States for energy today is used for cooling. Water is a very good cooling fluid for power plants. It gets rid of the waste heat. It's very efficient, very high heat capacity, and it's been plentiful in the past, and it keeps the costs of electricity down. That is the largest use of water, but it's a very significant use of water because you and I all are interested in, you know, low energy bills, because low energy means low products and low transportation costs. And, you know, as energy goes up, as we've seen in the last several months, a lot of things go up because a lot of things are tied to energy. So if we want to try and maintain long-term control over the costs of energy, we're going to have to make sure that we look at the water issues associated with that to make sure that we have enough water or have enough ways to develop energy and use energy that are water efficient.
Mm-hmm. Something else that I want to bring in here, and this comes off as part of the information on this issue that I have looked at that's on your website, that is on the Sandia Labs website, that is this observation that while it is the case that a lot of federal money is going into research on energy issues, looking at energy technology and energy efficiency and the issue of the environmental impact and concerns about renewables and alternatives, all this, we certainly are putting money into that effort. What it says here is that currently there is no national research program directed specifically at understanding the intimate relationship between energy and water. And the argument that you all there are making is that in the puzzle that we're trying to fit together, that will say something about what our energy use is and how we use it and how we're going to deal with our demand for energy in the future, that this particular piece, that is the relationship between energy and water, no one's really looking at that, at least not in a in a concentrated way.
Well, I think that in the past, let me just go back 25 years or so, when we had a huge increase in the number of power plants that were going in, you know, we were at 200 million people. We didn't have computers in every office. So I think in those days, there was a lot of water available. Power plants were built with water for cooling and things like that. And then over the past 25 years, we haven't built a lot of power plants. And in that period of time, we've added 50 to 100 million people in the country that all are requiring water for food and water for domestic supplies. And we're now in the process of increasing significantly the number of power plants that we're going to need. Because in the 70s and 80s, we overbuilt power plants. Now we've kind of not built any. We're getting ready to build some more. So it hasn't been a big issue in the past 10, 15 years. And what we're seeing is that as people are beginning to move forward and adding additional plants, they're running up to the fact that over the past 20, 25 years, they've had these changes in water supply that are going to have to be looked at. So I think this is something new that has developed or has been developing over the past decade, and people are just beginning to realize it. And we're at a point where we need to start looking at this long-term because as we build power plants, they last 40 or 50 years. And we've got to start looking at these issues today to make sure that the power plants we build 5 years and 10 years down the road are designed to address some of the competing demands for water that we're going to see. So I think a number of activities are underway on energy research that will help impact and reduce water demands, including renewable energy like wind and solar photovoltaics that don't require any water to generate power. There are other technologies, dry cooling, that could be used to help minimize the amount of water that's used. There's non-traditional water resources, wastewater and brackish water that can be used to minimize the use of fresh water. But all of those currently have problems that need to be addressed and need to be looked at and science and technology focused on to try to minimize the economic disadvantages of those technologies or the intermittency of those technologies or their ability to integrate with the current grid system. So there are research activities underway, but there's no one that has kind of coordinated that and said, we've got to get all of these going together to make sure that we don't get in a situation where water is the major driver for energy development 10, 15 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let me just quickly introduce again our guest for anyone who's just tuned in. We're talking with Mike Hightower. He's a civil and environmental engineer. He's a member of the technical staff in the Energy Security Center at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And among other things, he's interested in research and evaluation of energy technologies and also security and protection of critical water and energy infrastructures. And what we're talking about here this morning is the relationship between connections between water and energy and the important role that water plays in energy production and the fact that in future there is this expectation that as the as population grows, there will be increasing demand for water. And also there might well be increasing competition between residential use and between various industrial uses, among them agriculture and power generation, which are the two big ones. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number here for Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that would be good anywhere that you could hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in someone in Effingham. Let's talk with them. Line number four, toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you, David. It's the utmost importance, things like this, about our water. Two things. I saw a mock-up of the Great Lakes, and they use the straw, the drinking straw, for a metaphor. And the straws were into Lake Michigan, all the Great Lakes, siphoning off the water to where it's arid. Well, that is a concept. It would be straws of a certain magnitude under the ground or above the ground or however they would siphon the water off and take it to these arid places. I don't know if you are familiar with that. And the other thing is the recent studies about the pollution of fresh water and the residue of barnacles. Are you familiar with that?
That's a slightly different sort of subject. One actually, in fact, that we're talking about getting somebody to have here on the program. But I don't
okay.
know if
well,
that.
If you're not a dog, I thought perhaps the subject was water, David.
You're right. The subject is water. I'm just saying that particular aspect. I'm not sure whether that's something that our guest is within his.
Well, okay, I understand the power plants and all those sorts of things, but the use of wastewater and all the ramifications of that through those facilities, but. The water that goes in there, and it's connected to we humans pretty 3 to 5 days and no water or decent water and you're dead. So, if it's not germane, then I apologize for that. So I'll ring off.
Well, that's fine. I didn't mean, maybe I was being a little bit abrupt. Certainly what the caller says about the importance of water to human life is very much true. And that there certainly are concerns about water quality and about things that might be in the water, various kinds of chemicals. And just recently, there seemed to be a lot of interest at various places around the country. They're conducting tests of tap water and to find out what's in there. And they're finding out that there are in trace amounts all sorts of things, industrial chemicals, prescription drugs, many things. And that does indeed raise some questions about what's in the water and whether that indeed has some impact on human health.
Dave, I could maybe answer one of your caller, a couple of, or add some comments.
Sure. Yeah, please do. Please do.
And a couple of things that he mentioned that will be of interest in the energy industry as we move forward and will be of interest to people across the country, and that is in resources like the Great Lakes. Are those resources going to be made available to people around the country, or should that be a regional resource? And there are compacts being looked at between the U.S. and the Canadian government on how do you use the Great Lakes water resources, how do you do it sustainably. And those are issues that definitely need to be addressed, because as you begin to identify how it's sustainable to use your resources, then that begins to put limits on what you do with your water. And I think in the past we haven't really looked at the long-term sustainability of these resources and tried to identify exactly how much we have and use. And that's why it's so important as we move forward with energy development that we make sure that we do energy development and water development in an integrated fashion such that they're both sustainable. That's one point. Mm-hmm. Second point, on the pharmaceutical issues, as far as electric power generation, two things. One is, if we move forward on trying to take these pharmaceuticals out, it's going to require significant amounts of energy. So it could exacerbate some of the problems, and we see that right now in that the growth in some of these trace elements and trying to remove those, the significant energy demands associated with cleaning water that people a lot of times have not considered in their energy development portfolios down the road. And we need to begin to consider that. Second thing about wastewater is that if we begin to use wastewater more often for power plants, for thermoelectric power plant cooling, there will be issues that we're going to have to address about the contaminants in the water. How are those, can those be aerosolized in these evaporative cooling systems? What are the health impacts? So we're going to have to start looking at water a little bit differently as we begin to use non-traditional water resources, including wastewater for power plant cooling, as we try to conserve our freshwater resources. So his points do have an impact on how we apply and address these energy and water sustainability issues down the road.
Yeah. Well, I should apologize. I didn't really mean to dismiss the questions, because as you say, and as the caller suggests, there is certainly reason to be concerned about water quality, what is in the water, that, and as you say, that filtration technologies certainly exist, but then there's this question of, well, if you're going to do that, then what's it going to cost? What will that technology cost? And then certainly an issue, and it's actually one that from time to time we have talked about around the Great Lakes. The governments of the United States and Canada and the state governments of those states that surround the lakes are very concerned about water quality in the lakes because they consider that to be an important resource. And there are other places in the, I don't know if in the world, certainly in the United States, that look at that, thirsty places that look at all that water and think, well, wouldn't it be great if we could build a pipeline from Lake Michigan to Arizona? So that all of these are certainly serious questions. And when you get to the point of more and more competition, pressure on the resource that exists, obviously these things are all going to come up, even, and there'll be more, probably more controversy and conflict around them than there has been in the past.
Right, and which is the reason that we need to start looking at this definition of sustainable energy and water and natural resources development and put that in perspective. And it's not too early to start doing that, because as we see in the Southeast right now, major drought. Major droughts come to the Southeast every 10 to 15 years. 15 years from now, when they have the next major drought, if we haven't improved the way that we manage water and energy and integrate those, we'll have another 50 million people in the Southeast, and we'll really have a difficult time 15 years from now for the next drought that we will experience there. We've got to start addressing these issues today and make sure that we have plans in place and approaches in place to look at sustainable use of energy and sustainable long-term use of water.
Yeah. Well, we have some other callers here. We'll talk next with someone in Charleston, and that's line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
We recently had the rug pulled out from under us relative to the siting of Supergen site outside of Mattoon. And, of course, that's involved with carbon sequestration and using a highly efficient, I believe, coal gasification system for burning coal and handling the pollutants from it and so forth. Is that sort of technology what you have in mind that may potentially make use of less water compared to other, say, traditional coal-fired power plants?
Futuregen is a technology to gasify coal and to then make the waste stream in a form that could be easily reinjected and reduce the carbon footprint.
Yes.
The issue that, from a water standpoint, that you have around that right now is the gasification process and the cooling processes both take water. They're not significantly more than you would use for a power plant today, but there is a lot of energy required for the carbon sequestration, for the injection of the recovered gas into the aquifers, into a subsurface repository. And
so
there are issues around how much water that will take. So in one case you're minimizing the carbon, but you may be increasing the amount of water that you use. So there's definitely some research that needs to go into that to try to reduce those energy costs and reduce the water demands associated with that.
So you don't view that technology as it stands now, and of course it's in a very embryonic stage, of potentially helping the water situation just by the sheer improvements in energy efficiency or energy generation efficiency, say compared to a large a coal-fired power plant.
No, I think from a water standpoint, they're similar.
Okay, thank you. The other question I had was relative to the nuclear side. The only non-water use or limited water use technology in as far as nuclear power plants are concerned that I'm familiar with was the one at Chernobyl, which obviously had an unfortunate connotation for nuclear power worldwide. But I believe that they used an air-cooled system there, or am I mistaken that?
I am not familiar with Chernobyl, but I will tell you that currently in the United States and most of the power plants that I know of are water-cooled.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
And we've had some recent discussions with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and the nuclear industry on what we might be able to do and what research is needed to try and develop some approaches for new nuclear power plants that will not require, one, as much water, or could go with alternative cooling systems like dry cooling.
Yeah, tell me more about dry cooling.
Dry cooling is very much like refrigerated air conditioning, if you
mm-hmm.
will. You use the air as your cooling fluid rather than water. And I think most people understand, maybe they don't, but there's not as much thermal capacity in air as there is in water. So
yes.
You have to provide lots and lots and lots of air to run across a condenser to cool the fluid in a power plant. So in many cases, the footprint of the power plant increases substantially when you have to go to a dry cooling system. There are some inherent costs associated with that, which are increased capital costs. And then right now, operationally, dry cooling with air, where you use air as a cooling fluid, has problems many times in the summer months of the year in some parts of the country, specifically the Southwest, Southeast, and some areas, where the air is so hot and dry that you can't move enough air through it to do the cooling. And in the summertime, unfortunately, that's when you really need the most energy production in California, in the West, and in some places in the Southeast, is for your air conditioning loads. So because of that, you have to derate your power plants. And so we're trying to identify ways to improve the efficiency and the costs of dry cooling such that you don't take such a huge performance penalty in those July, August, and September time frames when you really need that power significantly. Dry cooling works very well in most parts of the country in the wintertime, where you have really cold air temperatures. It is in the summertime where you have really hot air temperatures that you can't get the cooling that you need, and so you have these extra costs associated with that.
I see. Thank you very much.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. All right. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller I want to get to in just a second, but I do want to, again, introduce our guest, Mike Hightower. He is a civil and environmental engineer. He's a distinguished member of the technical staff in the Energy Security Center at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. His current efforts include doing research and evaluation of innovative environmental and energy technologies and also security and protection of critical water and energy infrastructures. He's now serving as project leader for a development of a science and technology roadmap for the Department of Energy for energy water research and development. And again, sort of the point we started out wanting to make and discuss was the significance of water in the generation of energy and the expectation that over the next couple of decades, there's going to be increasing competition among various kinds of users, including domestic users, but also in industrial users. And those certainly include agriculture, but to a very large extent, they also include power generation. And the question is there in the future, is there going to be enough water to go around? And we have a couple of callers here, and we'd be happy to welcome others. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we will talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I'm listening, but I still was impacted by the amount of water that was used for irrigation. And I know if you don't want to comment, you know, on it, but it seems to me certain sections of the country may not make sense to irrigate, and also some of the crops that we have, in other words, like cotton and all that kind of stuff. So the other one that, you know, that I bring up from time to time is conservation. I mean, we just are so wasteful in, with the use of energy in this country. So anyway, any of those items you'd like to comment?
All right.
Let's hit the water use for agriculture. There's no doubt that irrigated agriculture is a big user of water, and that occurs in many parts of the western U.S. and in some places in the Midwest, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and other areas. So I think that as we look at competing demands for fresh water supplies, definitely we're going to have to look at improved efficiency in agriculture. Now, we have done some studies and looked at agricultural efficiencies in water use, and agriculture over the last 20 years has improved by about 20% in their overall efficiency. But what they have done is they've taken that additional water savings and have applied it to additional land and are irrigating more land and growing more crops. And part of that's because we have a growing population, growing world population. So the growing population is going to have food, and so we're going to have to try to trade that off. So I think that everybody needs to conserve, and that gets to the second point that the caller made, is that about efficiency and conservation. I think that there's no doubt that the easiest thing to do, that the cheapest thing to do, is to conserve water and to conserve energy. And the interesting thing, and I've told this to other people on other talk shows, is that if you turn your lights out, you're going to save water, because a lot of water is used for electric power generation. you don't drive your biofuel car or your ethanol car as much, you're going to save water because there's a lot of water that goes into to making your transportation fuels. So I think the lowest hanging fruit, the easiest thing for us to do, is definitely conservation. And if we could reduce energy consumption by 20%, we're going to conserve that much additional water. If we can conserve water by 20%, we're going to be much better off. So I think that one thing we can all do is start conserving, and that's going to help both energy and water.
All right. Let's talk with another caller in the community of Belgium, not too far away. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to segue into something slightly different here. The energy sources you've been talking about have pretty much been carbon-based and been pretty much all traditional type energy sources. Where we are at a point in our nation's situation where we could use some new technology to move on and become a more economically viable nation, and we need to work into doing something that is slightly out of the box. Now, it seems to me that hydrogen would be a good direction to go, and also in that same vein, to go back to some of the concepts that Edison had, and that's more or less direct current. To all the power you're talking about is AC current, which consumes a lot of that water. We don't produce direct current to use very locally. In other words, produce your power on your site, on your location, and really use a 10-volt system to run LEDs and stuff like that for your house. You could generate that electricity with solar cells right on your own roof. We can also use hydrogen in many other ways to not have to use so much water or produce the carbon pollution that was a problem in our nation. Also, at the same time, the technology can give us new ventures to produce more jobs for our citizenry. Hello?
Yeah, Mr. Hightower, I'm particularly interested in what you have to say about the hydrogen.
Let me touch the hydrogen issue. Hydrogen today, there's three ways that I know of to create hydrogen. One is steam reforming a natural gas. That's the way it's generally done today. And I will tell you that if you do steam reforming a natural gas, you use about five times as much water in doing that steam reforming, which is a water-based process, per equivalent energy content of fuel versus petroleum hydrocarbon fuels. So steam reforming a natural gas to make hydrogen is very water intensive, and people are going to begin to understand that as we move forward, that the hydrogen is not a free commodity. It does take water to create hydrogen. It takes a lot of water. The other way to create hydrogen is by electrolysis of water. Again, you need a lot of water for the electrolysis of water to make hydrogen. The third way is through hydrogen production in nuclear power plants. And in that case, you also need a lot of water to cool the nuclear power plant. So hydrogen is not necessarily a savior, it's not a free lunch, if you will, as far as low water use. It does take a lot of water. People need to start looking at that, and they are beginning to look at the water demand for hydrogen. There are technologies that do not require as much water and require very little water. PV, photovoltaics, solar cells do not require any water to generate electricity. So solar cells that you put on your house that can run appliances in your home definitely are going to save water. They have some cost issues, and we need to bring those costs down. Wind energy also requires absolutely no water, pretty much no water for electric power generation. So that's where technology that can be implemented. It's relatively inexpensive. It's growing by leaps and bounds, but it has an intermittency problem that we have to address as we move forward to really take full use of wind power that we have. So there are some alternatives other than fossil fuels from electric power generation that we can go toward, but there are still some roadblocks in using those that we really need to help move forward so that we can try to save our water. The hydrogen issue, though, is one that we really need to look at closely, and I think a lot of people are. Does hydrogen, is it water efficient? Is it cost effective? And does it make sense from an infrastructure standpoint?
All right. Again, I want to thank the caller. We're getting kind of short on time, and I have a number of others, and I want to go on to Rantoul next, and this will be line number one. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I would like to address the issue of use of wastewater and the new ethanol plant that I believe is being built or is going to be built in Champaign County. The Urbana-Champaign Sanitary District has attempted to talk with the owners of that ethanol plant about the use of wastewater from the sanitary district and has gotten no cooperation on that. And we have a very nice aquifer that a number of communities draw from and that is going to be used by the ethanol plant, which is it's not an unlimited amount of water, and we need to conserve that. And I'm concerned that the ethanol plant owners have not been cooperative in looking at how they could save water that's in the aquifer and make use of wastewater in production of the ethanol.
I think it's a great idea to look at wastewater use for power plants, for ethanol plants. There are some water quality issues with that that have to be addressed, and I don't know your specific situation. I don't live in the Illinois area, but I do know that there are some developers of ethanol that are looking at non-traditional water resources like wastewater or brackish water that they can use. Right now, it may be for your area, it may be a little bit too costly, but I think if you look at a long-term sustainability standpoint, you will see in the future more and more ethanol plants looking at resources like wastewater, because in many parts of the process, the wastewater can be used. And that's what we're beginning to see. I'm not sure that it can be used everywhere, but we are seeing interest by ethanol and biofuels companies in using wastewater resources. Hopefully, they'll work with you and come up with an equitable solution for everybody in that area of Illinois.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thanks. Just I'm glad that the caller raised the question of water use and the manufacture of biofuels, because it's something I think that people are increasingly concerned about. Can you say something about how much water is going now into biofuel production, and if we got the production level of biofuels to the point where some people are advocating, how much water would they be using, and how would that enter into this equation as we think about the competition for water?
Well, I think right now people are talking around the country, and this are some of the Department of Energy, National Science Foundation, that maybe by 2030, 30% of our transportation fuels would come from alternative fuels. That would include from oil shale as well as biofuels. And if you look at the numbers associated with biofuel production, right now we use about 1 billion gallons a day for our transportation fuels, a billion gallons of water a day for our transportation fuels production. If we did go to 30% biofuels and alternative fuels, that number would jump to about 3 billion to 4 billion gallons of water a day. If you put that in perspective, right now, in the United States, we use about 10 billion gallons of water a day for domestic uses nationwide. So the biofuels industry and alternative fuels could become a significant portion of our future water resource demands if they chose to use fresh water all the time. So there is going to be a need, I think, and many people have agreed with this, National Science Foundation, that we're going to have to work with the biofuels industry to try and reduce their water use and improve their processes such that they can minimize some of the water demand down the road. if we go to irrigated agriculture for biofuels, the numbers jump up tremendously because we use a lot of water in irrigating fuels or irrigating crops right now for biofuels production, which suggests that some of the other technologies like cellulosic ethanol, which don't have to be irrigated at all or very little, are ways we probably need to move in this country. But we don't have a cellulosic ethanol plant yet. I know that people at the National Renewable Energy Lab are trying to get some pilots instituted, but we need to move that technology forward as fast as we can.
Yeah, certainly. I know there are some people on this campus that, in fact, are doing some research connected with the potential development of cellulosic ethanol. So
it's something that we need to push forward on very quickly if we're going to move that direction, because it's going to help us reduce our water demands down the road. And we need to start looking very closely at increasing the overall efficiency of these biofuel plants.
All right. We go to Urbana next, line number 3, for another caller. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I was interested in this biofuel thing. The more I look at it and the more I understand how much energy it requires and how much water it requires, I think we're in a losing proposition even now if it wasn't for government subsidies. One other thing, look, I just got on the air with you, turned on the radio about a half an hour ago or less. I was in Chicago visiting with my family, and I saw an article on, I think ABC, it was one of the national networks, of a nurse talking about the huge waste of medicines for nursing home patients, medicines that weren't used by the nursing home patients, and she's talking about how they flush it all down the toilet. And thinking, boy, is there a big disconnect here, because that's a part of the problem with water quality is the pharmaceuticals in the water. And this gal is taking, bushels of drugs and flushing them down the toilet in her institution.
Yeah, I think you're going to see down the road that practices like that are going to have to be stopped.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is that we're going to try to treat our water supplies to these part per trillion levels or part per billion levels of these trace contaminants. And doing things like that puts a lot of stress on your water treatment system, and we're going to have to go to new technologies, all that are very energy intensive. And we're not going to be able to do this. We're going to have to make a better job of managing our water resources and our energy resources together such that we don't do the kinds of stupid things you just mentioned, because then we have to go in and put some very, very energy-intensive treatment technologies in our wastewater treatment plants to take that out because somebody dumped it down the toilet or dumped it down the drain.
Right.
We don't want to do that. We've got to be much better at that.
Yeah, we are using a lot of water for irrigation, a lot more in Illinois than I've ever seen. As the years go by, I keep seeing more and more, and most of it is the overhead spray-type irrigation, which is really not very efficient at all.
It's more efficient than flood irrigation, but it still is not as efficient as some of the lower-impact, lower irrigation approaches.
Right.
You're absolutely correct.
All right. Yep. Thank you. I'll let you go.
All right. Thank you. And we'll try here to get one more caller, and I believe this will be in Urbana, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. You were talking about hydrogen uses earlier, and one type of use you didn't mention was using hydrogen as a means of energy storage with photocells and wind power. Is this water efficient, or would it take a great deal of water? It appears as though it would be fairly efficient.
I think when you're talking about wind power and hydrogen, I think you're talking about electrolysis.
Yes.
Of water
for storage, because you can only generate wind when you've got wind power when you've got wind, and of course solar power only when the sun is out.
Yeah, I don't know how efficient or how well that is going to work. I don't have an answer for that. I'm not up to speed. I do know that using wind to do hydrolysis of water does take water, does take a lot of water, and how efficient that would be from a whole systems perspective, I have not looked at that yet. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough.
All right. We're at pretty much at the point where we're going to have to stop here. I guess I'm just interested in having you talk for about a minute about what's going on now, how much research is going into this this thing that, you know, we're calling the water energy nexus, that is the important connections between these two things, and trying to pay as much attention to water and its importance as we do the way we use energy and the search for alternatives and so forth.
As far as an integrated program anywhere in the U.S. or internationally, there's not an integrated program on energy and water. There are a number of places where water's being researched and where energy's being researched and where people are beginning to look at the connection between the two, but there's currently not a energy-water research program either in the U.S. or internationally. And international countries are beginning to see the same kinds of problems. France, Italy, Germany, Denmark are beginning to see this connection between energy and water and are looking at road mapping activities and science and technology directions to address these. So I think we're beginning to get, the word's beginning to get out. People are beginning to see how these two natural resources are very much connected. So I'm confident that as we move down the road in the next several years, that people will become more familiar and more research and science and technology development will be focused on this close connection between energy and water.
All right. Our guest is Mike Hightower. He's member of the technical staff in the Energy Security Center at Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Want to read more about this or other energy issues? You can go to their website, which is www.sandia.gov. And Mr. Hightower, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David.